On to another unit now, starting with a chapter that is about the cell cycle. And what I mean by the cell cycle is everything that happens within the lifetime of a single cell. So the cell cycle begins when a cell is created, and it ends when that cell, in effect, ends its own life by splitting into two new cells. So it's one generation of cells, basically. We see in the opening slide here that cell division is important for a variety of reasons. Reproduction, here, the first one listed, that's reproduction of a unicellular organism. We're obviously multicellular organisms, but there are plenty of, most organisms alive right now, and always has been true, are unicellular organisms. Well, they reproduce by splitting into two new cells, which, by the way, is different in a lot of ways from how we reproduce, but one glaring way in which it's different is that the parent no longer exists, right? It's not like a mother giving birth to a child. The mother still is the same person. She still exists. But a bacterium or any unicellular organism that divides into two cells has created two offspring cells but has ceased to exist in the process. The parent no longer is there, right? But anyway, that involves cell division, and which is an important part of the cell cycle. I mean, it's really the defining event in the cell cycle, because how I defined it as beginning when a cell is created and ending when that cell splits, that cell division that is happening at that start-finish line of the cycle. This has to do with what we call in biology cell theory. One major tenet of cell theory is that all cells come from pre-existing cells. We talk about this a little bit in a different chapter. Cells don't just pop into existence. You have to have a cell there already to create a new cell. And the way that happens is by cell division, which starts a new cell cycle. And then that cell cycle will continue until that cell divides. But reproduction is one use of cell division. Growth and development is also listed here as one category, basically. But growth and development are separate things. Growth, of course, refers to getting bigger, whereas development refers to cells taking on specific roles. So first of all, growth. Even a unicellular organism grows, because if you think about a cell dividing to create two brand new cells, obviously those two brand new cells are not going to be just as big as the one cell that just split into two, right? They're going to be smaller, of course, for a while. And so even a unicellular cell, organism, that one cell can get bigger. But growth here is more appropriately referring to how it happens in a multicellular organism. We are, comparatively speaking, huge organisms. We're bigger than most living things. But we get big not just by having the one cell that we start out as getting huge. We're not one human-sized cell. We are trillions of cells. So multicellular organisms get big by adding more and more cells. And that, of course, involves cell division. Development, though, refers to the process of turning into a mass of cells of differentiated types. So not only are we multiple cells rather than, we start out as one zygote, a single cell. We're not only not just a huge zygote, we're multiple cells, but we're also made up of multiple different kinds of cells. So the trillions of cells that we are made of right now are not just identical to the original zygote we started out as. There are nerve cells, there are muscle cells, and so on. They develop along the way into different kinds. And then the third one here, C, tissue renewal. Now, this applies only to multicellular organisms. Only multicellular organisms can have tissues, because if you think back to the hierarchy of biological organization that we started first day with, atoms make up molecules, molecules make up organelles, organelles make up cells, and so on, all the way up to the biosphere. Well, tissues are collections of cells of different types doing a certain job as a tissue. Obviously, only multicellular organisms have that. But tissue renewal specifically refers to replacing cells that have been damaged or killed or that have intentionally died for a certain reason. This happens in us all the time. We're 100 trillion cells, roughly, as an adult, but we lose billions of cells every day, just in red blood cells alone, and skin cells are another big loss of cells, just as a normal course of living. Red blood cells, for instance, can't live very long because for a couple reasons. One is that, at least in mammals, which we're members of, as part of developing into red blood cells, those cells lose their nucleus. So a red blood cell in you does not have a nucleus. Well, the nucleus houses the DNA, which is where the genes are, right? So if you need to make any proteins, you need to go to the DNA library to do that. Red blood cells can't do that. They've lost that nucleus so that they can basically make as much room as possible to pack in as much hemoglobin as possible, which does a very good job of carrying oxygen, which is what the red blood cells are about. But they can't repair themselves because they don't have any genes, so they don't live very long. And plus, they live a very rough lifestyle, being squeezed through tight spaces in capillaries, so they wear out in a couple weeks and have to be replaced. Continuously adding new cells requires, like blood cells or skin cells, requires making new ones, which requires cell division. So cell division, an important part of the cell cycle, used for these major reasons. Let's go on to slide 2 now. And look at a photomicrograph of a cell. In the dichotomy of cell types, what kind of cell is this? This is eukaryotic, definitely, right? Because you see a clearly defined nucleus, right? This is not a prokaryotic cell. It has a true nucleus. That's not really the point of the slide, though. The point is the contents of the nucleus, which collectively, remember, is called the nucleoplasm. Well, a chief component of the nucleoplasm, which is the dark purple stuff here, is a mixture called chromatin. I say it's a mixture because it's not just one category of molecule. Chromatin is a mixture of proteins and DNA. DNA, of course, is a nucleic acid, so that's one category of the four. Proteins are another category. So chromatin is the stuff that your genetic material is made out of. I mean, or it's that your chromosomes are made out of, I should say. But we don't see chromosomes here. It's a bit of a word game. Chromatin is the stuff. It's the combination of DNA and proteins, like I said. But in this picture, and throughout most of the cell cycle, you don't see individual structures here. This looks like just one big tangle, right? It's not really a tangle. It's the cell has it organized. But you can't see individual pieces. And so we don't call them at this time chromosomes. But eventually we will call, when you see them as individual structures, we'll call them chromosomes. Nothing has really changed about the makeup. It's still made out of chromatin when we call them chromosomes. We just don't use the word chromosome until we see it as a separate thing, separate from all the other chromosomes. Here we don't see individual chromosomes, so we just call it chromatin. An important point about this, though, is that I can tell by looking at this that this cell is getting ready to divide. Because if it weren't getting ready to divide, if it were just busy living its lifetime as whatever kind of cell it is, then we wouldn't even see these thick purple strands. It would look like just a one shade background in the entire nucleus, because the chromatin would be so unwound, so loose, that we wouldn't even see it like a rope here. So I can see by the appearance of the chromatin that the chromatin has already started to condense or get tighter. So it's on its way to getting as small as possible, which is when we call them chromosomes. And it only does that when it's about to split into two new cells. And by the time we see it here, where it's already condensing, which is before cell division that we're going to look at takes place, but by this time it has already undertaken one of the two major jobs of DNA. So I talked about this a long time ago now. I said that DNA has two major functions in a cell. What are those two functions? Two major processes that it directly takes part in. Transcription, not translation, it's not involved in translation. And replication, exactly. And what I'm saying here is that replication has already taken place. By the time you start seeing strands, even though they're not yet called chromosomes, when the chromatin has already started condensing into thicker and thicker, more compact stuff, the replication has already occurred. And I bring this up about cell cycle because when a cell needs to split into two cells that are viable cells, meaning that they are able to live on their own, both of those viable cells have to, of course, have not only DNA of their own, but they need to have just as much DNA as the parent cell had, right? In other words, a cell can't say, okay, you as one of my daughter cells gets half of my DNA and you as the other daughter cell gets the other half of my DNA. Neither one of them will live with only half of the amount of DNA that's required, right? They both have to get a full complement of DNA, a full set of genes. And to do that, starting with one full set to begin with, you of course have to make a copy of your full library of DNA so you have two copies temporarily, so that when you do split, you can give one copy to one cell and another copy to the other. That's what replication is all about. And that is a preparation for cell division, which has already happened here. And now the rest of the lifetime of this cell will be largely devoted to doing things in preparation for actually splitting into two. Slide 3. We've already defined chromatin as that mixture of DNA and proteins. We see on slide 3 in the black and white picture a chromosome. This is properly called a chromosome because now we can see it as a singular structure separate from all the other ones that look similar but are different from it within the same nucleus. It's still okay to say that this thing is made of chromatin. It is. It's just that when it's this compact as a single discrete structure, we call it a chromosome. And a chromosome, by the time you call it a chromosome, by the time it looks like it's its own piece, that's long after that replication that I just was talking about in the previous one. So the replication already occurred in the previous slide. That's way before we get to this point. So obviously it has already occurred later as well. And that's why by the time you call something a chromosome and see it as an individual structure, it is really made of two pieces that are identical copies of each other, but connected together, which is why we call it still a single chromosome. We can see this reflected in the fact that this kind of looks like an X, in a sense. Don't confuse that with what we call an X chromosome. That's a different thing. Each chromosome, though, is kind of an X because there's a cross place, a place where these two copies are connected together. And that place is called the centromere. But then on either side of the centromere, or on either side of the long axis, I should say, it's mirror image. What's held together at the centromere are two identical sister chromatids. So be careful with the terminology. There's a lot of things that start with basically the same couple of word beginnings. Chromatid and chromatin and chromosome can all be confusable if you don't pay attention. Especially chromatid and chromatin, which differs only by one letter. A chromatid is a complete DNA and the many proteins that hold it together. Okay, now, by the way, I say a complete DNA, I'm intentionally hesitating to say a single DNA molecule, even though we sometimes say that. What we call a single DNA is really, when you get down to it, two molecules, right? Because a DNA is a double-stranded nucleic acid, and each strand by itself is a polynucleotide made up of many nucleotides. That's one molecule in its own right. And then bonded to that by hydrogen bonds is another DNA, making up the overall, what we call one DNA, is really two molecules. But a chromatid contains one complete DNA, which is a double-stranded DNA, and then a bunch of molecules to pack it together tightly. A sister chromatid is an identical copy of that, identical genetically, meaning the DNA in the other chromatid is exactly the same as in the one that it's connected to. So sister chromatids make up one replicated chromosome. Now, eventually this chromosome will not be replicated. It'll be an unreplicated, or it'll split into two unreplicated chromosomes. But when you see it first appear as a chromosome, it is already replicated chromosome because the chromatin has already replicated by that time in the cell cycle. So the cartoon that we see in the middle column is really a lie. It's just here for clarity. This chromosome that you see at the top, notice it's only one piece. It's not two that are held together. You would never see that, though, because of what I've said. By the time it condenses to the point where you see it as a chromosome, it has already gone through the part of the cell cycle in which it replicated. So you would not see an unreplicated chromosome like this before splitting. It would exist just as chromatin, but only chromatin with enough DNA for one cell. All right? This middle one is not a lie. By the time that already replicated chromatin then condenses into however many replicated chromosomes that species has, then you do see it this way. So don't be confused by this lie. And then, of course, it replicated in preparation to have enough DNA for two cells. When it finally splits, each daughter cell will have just one of those copies that used to be called sister chromatids. When the sister chromatids split and go to separate cells, they're no longer called chromatids. Now they are fully chromosomes in their own right. It's just that they are now unreplicated chromosomes. All right. I guess it's not a complete lie, because as soon as the split happens, you would see it unreplicated for a while, but it's going to quickly unravel. It's going to undo that condensing that made it tightly coiled to begin with so that you could see it. It's going to unwrap and become loose again, because it needs to be loose for DNA to do its other major job, which is transcription. Right? Transcription is the job that DNA performs for the lifetime of that cell, being that kind of cell, whatever it is. Oh, someone left a phone here. It's not mine. A liver cell, for instance, has to do certain things to be a liver cell. Therefore, it requires certain proteins to do that job, and therefore it turns those genes on that are coding for those proteins for how to be a hepatocyte or a liver cell. So it spends certain time, which is really the main lifetime of that cell, doing whatever it does to be that kind of cell. That requires transcription of the appropriate genes. So you have to have that library available. When the chromatin drastically coils up to the point where you can see it as a chromosome, it's like making all the books in a library inaccessible for, like, let's say you're moving the library and you can't check out any books during that time because they have to pack it up tightly. Well, you have to undo that if you want to use the library again. And so that's why the unreplicated chromosome in the daughter cells will immediately start getting their DNA loose again, so that the DNA can be read as a code. All right, let's go to 4 and look at the overall cell cycle in this schematic drawn kind of like it's a cycle, it's a circular figure, but what I earlier called the start-finish line is down here in the yellow part, where cell division actually occurs. That's the beginning and the end of a one cell cycle. If you look at the outer edge of this circle, notice that the overall cell cycle, which is the entire trip around, consists of two major subdivisions. The bigger of the two, which is most of the time of the cell cycle, is interphase. And then the other part of the cell cycle can be either called the M phase or the mitotic phase. M stands for mitotic, so they both mean the same thing. But this is a little bit confusing as well. Mitotic is the adjective of mitosis. But the mitotic phase, even though it's named for mitosis, includes more than just mitosis. Okay, so don't use the mitotic phase and mitosis interchangeably. They are not interchangeable phrases. The mitotic phase and interphase combined make up one cell cycle. Each of those two primary subdivisions can themselves be subdivided. You can see this in the figure. Interphase consists in itself of three parts: G1, S, and G2. Now, the S phase, just talk about that first. S stands for synthesis, and specifically DNA synthesis. So this is the replication event. This is the one major job of two that DNA performs. It copies itself. And because of the way DNA is constructed, a DNA molecule can serve as a template for how to make an exact copy of itself for a new version of that DNA, or not a new version, an exact copy. And that happens in the S phase of interphase. So that had already happened by the time we got to that picture with the purple chromatin that I showed you. That's why I knew it was past S phase, because during S phase, you not only have to have loose DNA for those genes to be available to be read for transcription, but you also have to have that DNA be loose so that it's available for the enzymes to read the code of in order to copy it for replication. So that happens before the chromatin starts condensing. All right. Anyway, that's what the S stands for. And so by the time the cell gets to the S phase, it really has already committed itself to ending its own life in order to create two new cells. It's not going to happen immediately. It has to go through the S phase and the G2 phase before it finally gets to the M phase, which is when cell division takes place. But it's already said, okay, I've lived my lifetime as whatever cell I am. Now it's time to prepare for making two new cells. All right, so that brings us to the Gs. G1 and G2 are both stand for the same thing. They stand for gap, So the first gap phase, the second gap phase is what G1 and G2 really mean. But that's kind of a misnomer because it implies that nothing's happening, that it's just a gap in time. That's not true at all. G1, the first so-called gap phase, is really the main lifetime of the cell. I keep saying whatever kind of cell it is, right? So for once again, to use a liver cell for example, it spends its lifetime being a liver cell in G1. That's when it's busy just focusing on doing its job. And so in terms of DNA, the DNA is used during G1 for transcription of those genes that code for proteins that are required in being that kind of cell. All right? So that's a really busy time. It's not a gap at all. It's just that when you look at a cell during G1, you don't see really anything happening with the chromatin because it stays loose. It's being used, though, all the time for transcription. Then we have S, which I just described. And then G2 follows that. G2 also features a lot of transcription, just like G1 does. But G2 really isn't about transcribing the genes that are required for being that kind of cell. Like I said, it's already committed by the time it gets to S to prepare for splitting. So G2 involves transcribing genes that code for proteins that are necessary for the process of cell division. Okay? And that's also a busy time. It's just you don't really see anything happening microscopically to the DNA during that time. That's why they called them gaps. So those three, G1, S, and G2, make up interphase. By the time a cell gets to the end of G2, then it's ready for cell division. And cell division is the mitotic phase. But just like I said, you should not interchangeably use the phrase mitotic phase and mitosis. Also, you should not interchangeably use the phrases meiosis and cell division. And a lot of people do this. Probably a lot of instructors do this, and they shouldn't. Cell division is more than just mitosis. All right? Mitosis, officially, is division of the nucleus and its contents. Now, that definition should tell you right away that the only cells that ever undergo mitosis are eukaryotic cells, because they're the only ones with nuclei, right? So prokaryotic cells do not undergo mitosis. They undergo cell division. It's just not mitosis. It doesn't involve mitosis. We're talking here about a eukaryotic cell cycle. And so mitosis is just the division of the nucleus, which, of course, will only work if you already have gone through the S phase so that you have enough DNA for two cells and already in that one nucleus, so that when that nucleus splits, each of the two nuclei that result from mitosis will have a complete set of DNA, and they'll be identical sets to each other, the two nuclei. All right, but that's all mitosis is, division of the nucleus. In order to become two completely separate cells, of course, you can't just split the nucleus into two nuclei. You have to actually subdivide the rest of the cell. And so what do we collectively call the rest of the cell other than the nucleus? The cytoplasm. Right? The cytoplasm is the stuff outside of the cell, outside of the nucleus. Well, you have to divide that as well if you're going to have a complete cell division event. So meiosis divides the nucleus, I mean mitosis, sorry. And a different part of cell division, a different component of cell division, is responsible for dividing the cytoplasm. That part of cell division is called cytokinesis, which is the other part of the M phase. Okay? So the mitotic phase is not just mitosis. The mitotic phase is both mitosis and cytokinesis. Now, of these two components of cell division in a eukaryote, mitosis and cytokinesis, they're both division events, but they don't have to both be as careful, as highly careful. One of those two processes has to be much more careful than the other. Which one has to be more careful? Mitosis has to go off without a hitch, right? Because if you accidentally give one cell more than its share of DNA, that means you're shorting the other cell, right? Well, getting too much DNA is bad in itself. That can cause cell death. And not getting enough DNA is certainly going to cause cell death because you're missing genes. So mitosis has to be a very, very careful process to ensure that each of the two daughter cells, well, each of the two nuclei that will become parts of the two daughter cells, have a complete, normal set of chromosomes. All right? Cytokinesis, on the other hand, just has to roughly divide the rest of the cell in half. What I mean by that is the cytokinesis doesn't say, okay, there's 48 chromosomes in this plant cell. I have to make sure that exactly 24 of them go to this cell and 24 go to the other cell. Or same with mitochondria, for instance. Or exactly half of the endoplasmic reticulum goes. It's just roughly a split in two so that they both can survive. But the nuclei have to be identical. By the time that ends, the mitotic phase is done, you have no longer that original cell. Instead, in its place, you have two new cells, each of which will enter its own cell cycle as the G1 phase of interphase to begin with. And it just continues like that. So then, next thing to talk about are the specifics of mitosis, which we're looking at in slide 5. But actually, the pictures that we see here are more than just mitosis. It includes all of mitosis, but includes a little bit before mitosis and a little bit after as well. You see real micrographs that have been colorized on the top, but it's much more instructive, I think, to pay attention to the cartoons in order to understand the important events that are happening in each of these phases in mitosis. There are 5 subdivisions of mitosis. Now, mitosis is already, think in terms of the cell cycle, it's a subdivision of a subdivision already, right? Because mitosis is a subdivision of the M phase, and the M phase is a subdivision of the cell cycle. Now, so we can split mitosis into 5 subphases that just make up mitosis. And those, as we see here, in order, are called prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. Now, this last one is labeled as telophase and cytokinesis, but only telophase is part of mitosis. Cytokinesis is its own thing. So those are the 5 subdivisions of mitosis. The reason, by the way, that cytokinesis is lumped in there with this last picture, labeled as telophase and cytokinesis, is that mitosis does not, cytokinesis does not wait until mitosis is totally done before cytokinesis starts. In other words, the two major parts of the M phase, which are mitosis first and then cytokinesis, they overlap in time. Cytokinesis starts before telophase ends, and therefore they're shown both in one picture. Just make sure you don't think that cytokinesis is part of mitosis. It's its own process. Okay, now if we pay attention to the cartoons, this first one is not yet in the M phase. This is labeled as G2 of interphase. So remember from the cell cycle picture, this is already a cell that has gone through S, right? And S is where there is a doubling of the DNA. That's where replication occurs. So you don't see any chromosomes here. It just looks like a tangle of chromatin. But by this point, there's already enough chromatin for 2 cells. And if you looked at the DNA pieces that make up this chromatin, there would be 2 of every one of the different pieces, one for each of 2 cells, 2 copies. Okay, and think back to when we had the chapter that was a survey of the different organelles. A tour of the cell, that chapter. That's when I first mentioned centrosomes to you, and I told you that a centrosome, which is kind of this cloudy area, is a microtubule organizing center. That's how I defined it at the time. And I said that in certain cells, like animal cells, within the centrosome there is a pair of centrioles forming this T-shaped, and you don't see those in plants. And it's also, these centrioles are the things that I said we haven't figured out what they're for yet, really. But we know that animal cells have them and plant cells don't. Well, anyway, the centrosome, there is just one centrosome to begin with in a cell. When it reaches the S phase, of course, it doubles its DNA because that's what the S phase is named for, right? But during that S phase, outside the nucleus, which is where the centrosome is, that centrosome also gets replicated. And that's why here in this G2 picture, which is after S, there are already two different centrosomes. There have to be two centrosomes because these centrosomes are going to form two different poles or opposite ends of what we call, eventually, once it's formed, a mitotic spindle. The mitotic spindle is a complex arrangement that includes both of the centrosomes, forming the two poles, and then connecting them are a complex arrangement of microtubules. Okay, now that hasn't formed yet, but that's why we see two centrosomes, whereas we only saw one in that picture in the tour of the cell. It starts out with one, and then the centrosome gets replicated in the S phase. Also notice that the nuclear envelope, which is, remember, two membranes thick, is intact here in G2. Still there. You have a fully defined nucleus still. Okay, now we can go on to the first subdivision of mitosis, which is prophase, and see how that differs from G2. So now we're officially in mitosis. Prophase, a couple important things are happening. One is that microtubules are growing out from each of the two centrosomes. Makes sense for a centrosome, since a centrosome is a microtubule organizing center, right? So these microtubules are polymers. They're proteins. They're part, they're made up of the microtubules that are one of the three types that make up the cytoskeleton. Well, these microtubules are polymers that need to be made by adding identical copies of proteins one by one to make them longer and longer. That's happening at the centrosomes. That's where the new material is added, and it's making them longer and longer. It's happening from both of the two centrosomes. Microtubules are growing out of both centrosomes. And notice that the microtubules that are growing out of each centrosome are interacting with the microtubules from the other centrosome. There's an overlap between them, and they're kind of pushing on each other. And this is causing the two centrosomes that started out right beside each other previously to separate from each other, to polarize, in other words, to go to opposite ends of the cell. And this is already labeled as early mitotic spindle. It's not ready for mitosis for its final job yet, but you can already see that it's becoming a mitotic spindle in prophase. So that's one important event. Let's look at what's happening, meanwhile, inside the nucleus, because this mitotic spindle is forming outside the nucleus. Inside the nucleus, of course, is where the chromatin is. And just before, in G2, which is before mitosis, the chromatin was there, of course. You just couldn't see any individual pieces. So we called it just chromatin. Now you can see that the chromatin has started to condense a lot more. So much so that you can almost count how many pieces there are. You can't tell for sure, but you can see that they're becoming distinct pieces visually. And so these are about to be called chromosomes. Like I said, it's a word game. It's the same stuff. It's just when you see it separately, then you call it a chromosome. And any given species has a certain number of chromosomes. It's just part of being that species. So for humans, for instance, there's 23 different kinds of chromosomes. Other species have more than we do. Corn has like 40. Others have fewer than we do. It just depends on the species. In this one, though, there are, looks like, 6 different kinds of chromosomes. Anyway, you don't necessarily see all 6 of them here, but an important event in prophase is that you have condensing of the chromatin into chromosomes. Finally, in prophase, the nuclear envelope is still intact. So that's still an official boundary between the nucleoplasm and the cytoplasm. Okay, now, prometaphase is next. Look what happened to the nucleus. The condensing of the chromosome, or the chromatin into chromosomes, that has progressed even further. So now the chromosomes are definitely distinct. We see them as, we can count how many there are, they're separate from each other. But because they're more condensed, they're smaller as well. All right? That's just kind of a continuation from prophase. What's different about prometaphase is that the nuclear envelope has now disintegrated. So really, officially, at this point, there isn't a true nucleus. Now, why would the nuclear envelope disintegrate? Well, because successful mitosis, division of that nuclear content, the chromosomes, in other words, requires interaction between the mitotic spindle and the microtubules it's made out of and the chromosomes. And they're in separate spaces originally, right? The mitotic spindle is out in the cytoplasm. The chromosomes are in the nucleus, with the nuclear envelope forming a boundary between the two. In other words, it's in the way. The nuclear envelope is in the way. So the only way to connect the microtubules of the mitotic spindle to the chromosomes is to get that boundary out of the way. The nuclear envelope has to disintegrate in prometaphase, at least in most species. In animals, which is what we're looking at here, that happens. The mitotic spindle also has now matured. It is now completely polarized. The two centrosomes are at opposite poles now. They can't be farther apart. And the microtubules have grown to the point that they're full size. Now, these microtubules that make up the mitotic spindle are all identical in terms of molecules. They're all made of the same exact stuff, in other words. But there are two different categories of mitotic spindles. Microtubules making up the mitotic spindle. They're all made of the same stuff, but they do two different jobs. Some of them are called kinetochore microtubules. You can see that word if you look at it close enough in your book, if you have one, but that's how you spell it. Notice that the kinet part of that, just like in kinetic energy or cinema, means moving. Kinetochore microtubules are the microtubules of the mitotic spindle that connect at one end to what are called kinetochores. That's why the microtubules are called kinetochore microtubules. So that brings up the question of what a kinetochore is. Well, you see one labeled here, but every replicated chromosome, and notice that these chromosomes are all replicated, right? Each one of them consists of two sister chromatids that are identical to each other. But each replicated chromosome not only features a centrosome, not only features two sister chromatids joined at the centromere that we talked about earlier, but the two sides of that single centromere each features a kinetochore. So there are two kinetochores on each replicated chromosome, one for each of the two sister chromatids. As far as what they're made out of, a kinetochore is a complex of proteins. But it's a connection point between that replicated chromosome that the kinetochore is part of and a kinetochore microtubule that's part of the mitotic spindle. All right? So that's one of the two categories of microtubules making up the mitotic spindle, kinetochore microtubules. And notice that kinetochore microtubules that grew from one centrosome, one pole, are going to be connected to one of the kinetochores on that replicated chromosome. And kinetochore microtubule from the other pole, the other centrosome, will be connected to the other kinetochore on the other side of the centrosome, other side of the centromere, of that replicated chromosome. Okay, so the words are get confusing here. But you can see that in pictures right here. This yellow kinetochore microtubule sprang from this centrosome. It's connected to the kinetochore on one side that is basically the same side as that sister chromatid, and the other one's coming from the other pole connected to the other kinetochore on that same replicated chromosome. That happens for as many chromosomes as the species has, which in this cartoon is 6. All right? I still haven't mentioned the other category, though, of microtubules in the mitotic spindle. Those can go by either of two names, one of which is non-kinetochore microtubule, but another name for those, and this book calls them non-kinetochore microtubules. Another name for them, though, is polar microtubules. Well, as the name non-kinetochore microtubules implies, these ones, even though they're made out of exactly the same stuff as the kinetochore microtubules, the non-kinetochore microtubules do not connect to kinetochores on the replicated chromosomes. Instead, the non-kinetochore microtubules, or polar microtubules, that are growing out of each centrosome interact with each other without connecting to any chromosome. Just like the ones originally did when I was saying they're pushing on each other. And so these polar microtubules are important not only in the original polarization and maturation of the mitotic spindle, but they continue to push on each other as they grow so that the cell, which is roughly circular at first, becomes oblong as the spindle gets even bigger, because of these polar microtubules interacting with each other. And that is obviously in preparation for a division of the cell. Okay, so that's going to be important. All right, so that's the events in prometaphase, the briefest of the 5 mitotic subphases is next. Doesn't take long to get through the next one, which is called metaphase. And metaphase is really just defined as the time during which these replicated chromosomes, however many there are, get moved so that they are placed all halfway between the poles. And the reason that they're able to do this is because they have already been connected to kinetochore microtubules of the mitotic spindle. Okay, so that's why that connection between kinetochore microtubules and replicated chromosomes is so important, so that they can then be dragged whichever way is appropriate for each chromosome to the halfway point. When they are halfway all, then we say that that is metaphase. And it looks like they're all lined up in a line in this picture. This is a 2D image. They're not really lined up. They're just all in the same plane, right? Because this is really three-dimensional. So you can think of an imaginary plane that goes through half perpendicular and halfway between the two poles. That imaginary plane is called either the metaphase plate or the equatorial plane. Either one of those phrases is fine. The metaphase plate kind of suggests that it's a real structural thing. It's not. It's just an imaginary mathematical plane. And so they don't have to really be lined up. They can be anywhere in that plane, but halfway between the two poles during metaphase. All right, anaphase is next. And the really important thing that happens in anaphase is that something actually splits. There hasn't been any splitting yet up to this point. In anaphase, you finally have things separating from each other. And in mitosis, in the anaphase of mitosis, and I say it that way because in a different chapter we'll learn about meiosis, which has its own anaphase. But in anaphase of mitosis, the two things that split from each other are the two identical sister chromatids that were making up what we called one replicated chromosome. And in this cartoon case, that's happening six times because there are six different replicated chromosomes, right? One, two, three, four, five, six. Each of them consists of two sister chromatids. And so when anaphase comes along, each of them splits into what you might think we would call sister chromatids still, since that's what they were named just a minute ago. But they undergo a name change. We call them chromatids when they're only part of a chromosome. But a chromatid by itself has enough DNA for one cell, for an entire chromosome of a cell. Because remember, they're two identical copies of each other, the two sisters. So when they're no longer connected by the centromere, we don't call them chromatids anymore. Now we call them chromosomes. But when that replicated chromosome splits into two chromosomes, the two chromosomes it splits into, being just one copy each, are unreplicated chromosomes. Okay? It might make more sense to call them chromatids still, but the reason we're going to call them chromosomes now is because they're going to be a chromosome in their own right, in its own cell eventually, once the cytoplasm has also split. So that's what happens in anaphase. Not only the splitting occurs, but they start separating from each other. Each one is going to go to its own, toward its own pole. And the other one, which is identical to it genetically, is going to move toward the other pole. That leaves, for mitosis, only one more subphase, which is the last one, telophase. Telo means far, like in telescope, viewing far. Telophase really is just a continuation of anaphase, but it gets to the point where the unreplicated chromosomes have now gotten all the way, made their trip all the way to the poles. Okay? Not only that, but in most cases, depending on species, a new double membrane nuclear envelope forms around each of these two poles, enclosing those two sets of chromosomes, those unreplicated chromosomes. So in other words, even though this is still officially one cell because it's all within one plasma membrane, there can be two nuclei now. There was one nucleus originally, but that nucleus contained replicated chromosomes. Now that the mitosis is complete, there are two nuclei, but each nucleus contains unreplicated chromosomes. It's the same exact amount of DNA, right? It's just splitting a doubled amount into two single amount sets. Okay. Remember I said, though, that even though mitosis comes before cytokinesis, they overlap usually, which is why this picture also features cytokinesis. Telophase is just what's happening with the nuclei. Cytokinesis is starting here, though, and since this is an animal cell, this happens a little bit differently from how it happens in plant cells, which we'll look at next. Plant cells have cell walls, as you know, which are much thicker and tougher things than plasma membranes. All cells have a plasma membrane, but that's all that's there for an animal cell. It doesn't additionally have a cell wall. And so an animal cell is pretty flimsy, since it just has that plasma membrane. That means this elongated cell, which is elongated because of the polar microtubules pushing on each other, can now just be cinched up in the middle, like pulling a belt or a drawstring. And you see that happening right here, creating what's called a cleavage furrow. To cleave means to separate. And a furrow is a ditch. So it looks like a cleavage furrow that's being dug all the way around. But the analogy that I used a little bit ago of a drawstring or a belt is more than an analogy. That's really what's happening at the molecular level. The difference is that the belt loops, which are normally for humans outside, facing outside, the belt loops are cytoskeletal structures that are inside the plasma membrane. And then there's a belt of proteins, also cytoskeletal elements, going through those belt loops. And then when that circle gets smaller and smaller by greater and greater overlap between the actin microfilaments, or what are really at play mostly, same things that are in your skeletal muscles causing them to contract. As that circle gets smaller and smaller, the cleavage furrow gets deeper and deeper until it finally pinches off all the way. And when it pinches off all the way, you officially have two full-blown cells, each with its own nucleus, because telophase that are already completed by the time you get to the end of the cytokinesis. And those two nuclei are identical to each other. Therefore, the cells, the two daughter cells, as they're called, even though it has nothing to do with sex, are genetically identical. Now, they're not only genetically identical to each other, which is important, they're also genetically identical to the original cell that split to form those two. And so that's a really important thing about mitosis in general. Mitosis and cytokinesis, they both happen normally, results in two cells from one. The two cells are genetically identical to each other, and they're genetically identical to the original cell. So if you think about this in terms of tissue renewal, one of those functions we looked at in the opening slide, you know, like for instance, you cut yourself, you're going to kill a million cells in that area, or however many. They'll die and disintegrate. You need to replace them with new cells. But you replace them with exact copies, right? They're genetically identical to the cells that are still hanging around and living. So you use mitosis and cytokinesis to do that. Meiosis, as we'll eventually see, does not do that. It creates genetically different cells. You don't want to do that if you're just replacing parts of your body. All right, slide 6. Now we can speed up a little bit in terms of getting through the slides. This is just a close-up view of metaphase, and it gives you a better idea of what I was talking about when I named either the equatorial plane or the metaphase plate, as it's labeled here. It's not a piece of glass. That's imaginary. But it just shows you the 3D aspect I was talking about. They're not really lined up. They're just all in the same plane at metaphase. It also gives you a much better view of the kinetochores, one on either side of the centromere holding together two sister chromatids. And kinetochore microtubules from opposite poles will connect to opposite kinetochores. And that's how the chromosome, whatever position it was originally, can be dragged to this midway point, this metaphase plate. Slide 7. Now, speaking of dragging them to the metaphase plate, there's two major, well, I mean, there's at least two ways this could happen, but there's two major ways that seem to make sense. I mean, if you know that microtubules are connecting to these things, you can think of it in two ways, macroscopically, to make sense of it. Kind of a rod and reel way of doing things. In other words, you cast out that line, the microtubule line, and hook the kinetochore and then reel it in. Or you can, once that connection is made between kinetochore and the chromosome, the kinetochore, which remember is a microtubule, can act like a little road along which the chromosomes can be moved. All right, so those are two different ways to explain the observance. Well, here we see the results of an experiment to try to narrow down which of those two is correct. And so, almost like they took a felt tip, but using microscopic techniques, they marked part of the kinetochore, part of the mitotic spindle. The microtubules now have this mark on them. If the rod and reel hypothesis is correct, if they're actually being reeled in at the centrosome, then you would expect that mark to stay where it is with respect to, you know, the chromosomes, but the mark and the chromosome should both move toward the centrosome, right, if it's being reeled in. On the other hand, if the microtubules are acting like little roads, then you should expect the mark to stay where it is, and the chromosome should approach the mark and eventually pass it on their way to the centrosome. So which one came true? Well, the second one. The mark stayed put, and the chromosomes moved toward the mark, past it, and then to the centrosome. So it's not the rod and reel hypothesis. Instead, what's happening is what we see in detail on the bottom. Microtubules you should already be familiar with as little roadways, right? Remember I showed you a slide from another chapter of a vesicle containing something being moved, walked one step at a time along microtubule with the action of motor proteins. We called them motor proteins, right? Each step required an ATP, I said. Exactly the same thing's happening here. You look at the detail of a kinetochore, which is the teal-shaped or teal-colored thing here. I already described the kinetochore as a complex of proteins, but part of those proteins are the red things, which are motor proteins. So after the connection is made by the kinetochore microtubules, then that microtubule is just a roadway along which the red motor proteins can walk, dragging the former sister chromatid, but after it has split, unreplicated chromosome toward that pole. And the other copy, the other former sister chromatid, is going to walk along its own microtubule in the other direction toward the other pole. Oh, by the way, the tubulin subunits. Tubulin is the protein monomer that you just stack together over and over to make up a long microtubule. But these tubulin subunits are coming off of the back of this because this microtubule is not only a roadway for this trip that the chromosome is taking, but that's a trip that is only ever going to be made once, right? So this is a road that only needs to be used one time, not reusable. And so as soon as the kinetochore walks along part of the road behind it that it's already been on is disintegrated into individual tubulins, which can be recycled to make more material in the cell. Okay, so the road is destroyed behind it, the thing that's walking along it. Now to 8. Well, I described cytokinesis in an animal cell, and we see that again on the left side here. This little better view of what I was describing as belt loops inside the cell made out of proteins, and then a belt made out of other proteins that are in it, and the overlap in that belt becomes greater and greater, and that causes the cinching up finally to separate into two separate daughter cells. Plant cells can't do that. Even if they were to try, they'd be unsuccessful because the cell wall is way too thick and strong, right? So a plant cell does... mitosis is basically the same in a plant cell as an animal cell, except that those centrioles aren't there in the centrosomes. But cytokinesis is different. And in a plant cell, what happens first is that vesicles form in the area where that metaphase plate is. Okay, so we already have two separate nuclei. Mitosis has occurred. And you can imagine the metaphase plate. You know, it's not a real thing. But in that position, vesicles form. Vesicles are little bags made out of membrane, right? Same material that the plasma membrane is made out of. We've discussed this before. But what is contained in these vesicles? Well, the stuff that cell wall is made out of. Okay? So it's just a bunch of little packets of cell wall material enclosed in plasma membrane material. And they not only form, but then they get bigger and bigger. And as they get bigger, they grow toward each other. Till eventually they hit each other. The vesicle membrane does, right? And membrane can fuse into itself, right? Just like in exocytosis and endocytosis. It's made of the same stuff. So when it comes together, it can fuse into just one membrane. And when that happens, instead of having multiple vesicles, you have one big cell plate. Now think about this. The cell plate is made out of cell wall material, but it's coated in membrane material. And that continues to grow until it actually hits the plasma membrane on either side of the cell. And once again, membrane fuses into membrane. So when that happens, now you have two official cells. Because the membrane material on this side of the cell plate is now part of the plasma membrane of this cell. And the same thing for the other side. And between the two is cell wall material. That was used to be the contents of the cell plate. Now it's officially outside of both of these new cells, just where you'd expect cell wall to be. So that's cytokinesis in a plant cell. 9 is not really any new information. This just shows you that it's not just cartoon imagination. It really looks like the cartoons. The cartoons are drawn from real things. So if you look at an onion root tip, for instance, which is typically what's used in teaching labs, and you'll look at them in either this week or next, whenever they have it set up, you can easily find cells that are in any one of the 5 stages. And why do we use onion root tips? Well, nothing special about an onion, really. They're just cheap. But the root tip is the best place on the onion plant to look, because the root tips are places where the root is getting longer all the time. Well, how do you get longer? By adding new cells. And so compared to the cells making up the rest of the body of the plant, the ones at the root tips are much more likely to be in mitosis to create new cells as part of cell division. Yeah.
What's the time frame for this?
That depends on the species and the conditions. It can be hours, it can be days. It just depends.
Once it begins.
That also depends on the species. In our body, that also probably depends on the cell type within our body. And also, you know, skin cells, this is happening to all the time because we have to renew them since we lose them continuously. A typical nerve cell, on the other hand, does not do it at all. So a typical nerve cell is as old as you are and might never divide. So there's no one answer. Okay, let's go to 10. Now, we've talked mostly about eukaryotic cells, but I mentioned earlier that prokaryotic cells have to divide as well. That's how they reproduce, right? Assuming that the bacterium does not get killed by something, assuming it lives a natural lifetime, that natural lifetime ends when it divides to form 2 new organisms identical to itself. But since it never had a nucleus, since it's a prokaryote, it does not undergo mitosis as part of its cell division. The cell division that most bacteria, or most prokaryotes even more generally, undergo is called binary fission. Fission simply means splitting, just like nuclear fission, and binary means in two. Now, even though there is no nucleus, there is a place in the cytoplasm of a prokaryotic cell where most of the where the DNA is located. So it's not just randomly strewn throughout the cytoplasm, the DNA, that is. It is collected into a place called the nucleoid, remember. And it's a little bit different from eukaryotic cells in a couple ways. One is that there's one chromosome, not several like there are in eukaryotes. And also, eukaryotic chromosomes are linear, right? They have two ends, each one. Whereas the one chromosome in a prokaryote is circular, no ends. But still, for the same exact reason, that chromosome in a prokaryote needs to replicate before it can undergo binary fission. Otherwise, the two daughter cells can't live. They each need their own full DNA set. So that happens in a bacterium or any prokaryote before binary fission, and for a while that bacterium will have twice as much DNA as it needs for its own lifetime, but it somehow doesn't get all tangled up and figures out how to separate into two, and so it all, what we call binary fission, accomplishes the same thing that occurs in as two separate processes in a eukaryote. When we look at slide 11, these are all eukaryotic cells. Well, the top one's a bacterium, sorry. So binary fission on the top, but all the rest of them, B, C, and D here, are eukaryotes. We studied eukaryote in an animal cell, and plant cells basically the same thing. But they are not all of the eukaryotes, right? There are fungi and there are protists that make up the rest of eukaryotes. And depending on species, they can do it a little bit differently. For instance, in dinoflagellates, there is no disintegration of the nuclear envelope like there is in animal cells I was talking about. It's in the way, but the way it's solved here is that the microtubules penetrate the nuclear envelope. And in still others, diatoms are kinds of protists that are eukaryotes. They have their centrosomes inside the nucleus, so they don't have to disintegrate the nuclear envelope at all. But the bottom one is how most of us do it, including all animals and all plants. Slide 12 is kind of the beginning of the rest of the chapter. We've talked about the particulars of mitosis and the cell cycle. But we haven't talked about how a cell knows where it's supposed to be at any given moment within the cell cycle. I said that a cell has already committed, by the time it gets to the S phase, of preparing to divide. In other words, to start ending its own life. But that still doesn't say how it knows to make that commitment. So an important part of the cell cycle is to have some sort of control over the cell cycle. And this is a result of two experiments to answer the question of whether there is some sort of chemical signal. Meaning, obviously there has to be some sort of signal controlling this, right? A fundamental question is it a certain kind of molecule? That's what I'm calling a chemical signal, as opposed to light, for instance, coming in. And so what they did is take a cell that's in the S phase and fuse it experimentally, once again taking advantage of the fact that membrane material can fuse together. They fused a G1 cell with an S cell to make one cell with two nuclei, but the original two cells are in different parts of the cell cycle to begin with, right? G1 comes before S, remember. And when they did this, immediately the nucleus that was part of the G1 cell by itself started to replicate its DNA, which is what happens in S, right? In other words, it looks like there's something in this S cell originally that's telling this G1 cell that it's now sharing a cytoplasm with, it's time to replicate your DNA. So that's evidence, not conclusive, but it's evidence that there is a chemical signal controlling the cell cycle. Even more strong evidence, though, is when they use the same technique, but fuse an M phase, it's already in mitosis with a G1. G1 is not even close to mitosis, right? It would normally have to go through S and then G2 and then finally get to the M phase. But when they did this, the nucleus that was in the G1 immediately starts trying to undergo mitosis, which it can't even do because it hasn't replicated its chromosome. It's trying to split when it only has one part to begin with. But it thinks it's supposed to, in a sense, because there is a chemical that it's being exposed to that is present in the M phase, the natural M phase one, telling it this is the phase you're supposed to be in right now. So I don't have time to tell you what the chemical is, but we'll start there next time.